I find a lot of, like, you know, the stuff I read that you've done and hearing the radio shows and all that, some of it I can grasp, a good deal of it I can't.
Right.
But I still kind of get off on the ideas, I guess almost like on an emotional plane or something, right? I like the way you display it. So what I'm wondering is it, do you advocate that type of understanding Bob, like Bob as entertainment, almost?
Oh, yeah. But it's not entertainment. I always remember what McLuhan wrote about Joyce. He said, Joyce communicated before and beyond understanding. A poet communicates before and beyond. It's almost like the communication between the lines and between the rhythms. If the poet knows what it's doing, it's got his breath right and it's doing self-communication, the people will respond, their subconscious will respond to the rhythms. And they will get good feelings from that or whatever, or entertaining feelings or intense feelings, fearful feelings. They'll get moved. And the moving is more than the registering of semantic meaning. So I don't expect you to not understand me, to understand me completely, and that's okay, because you will understand it. I always say go back and read it, check it out again later in 2 years, and you'll be amazed what you discover in it. I mean, like Dave, he read Entertainment Sucks years ago, but if he's saying that it's even more relevant now, maybe he reread it, he sees more of it. You know? So I want to make stuff that lasts, that you can see more.
That is true. When you go back and read it, you can definitely grasp a lot more.
And if what I'm saying is true, you, as a young person, can understand. You haven't had the experience I had. Why should you? But you're lucky if you say, I resonate with this. I see that this is worth paying attention to over time. Like I pay attention to Zappa and these guys because I knew they were trying to say something, you're not going to get it all. So just be smart enough to check in every now and then and remind yourself to be continuous with that. So I want people, if they're lucky, to be continuous with what I do because they will find a consistency in it as they understand more about other things in their life and then go back to it. I don't think that's entertainment. I think that's learning. But here's a great line. There's no difference between didactic poetry and lyric poetry, because what pleases the most teaches the most. So it merges.
Okay. You've also mentioned in the past that understanding Bob's media ecology involves a certain amount of pain.
Yeah, learning is painful. I mean, there's that old line we use, when you're laughing, you're learning. But when you're in pain, you're learning. But the pain is nowadays, you have so many distractions and so much things to fill your time in, it's painful to sit still, maybe hide away for a week and read something in depth and really try to figure it out. Because a lot of experiences you've missed over that week, you've been out of touch, if you think you need to know what's going on, you've missed the collective experience of people reading papers every day. They're processing all this stuff, and you're not part of the collective beehive mind, and probably some part of your brain self wants to be in touch. But it's painful to withdraw from that and do some of your own homework by yourself, sort of relive the isolated visual book reading experience. But I try to recommend really good stuff to read to make that worthwhile. So if that's it's not physically torturous, but it's kind of painful, and it's work, it's like weightlifting. So you got to do that.
And it's painful to come to an awareness of your thing? For understanding.
Painful to learn to control your mind or to see how it moves. So if you just merge with the crowd and do whatever you're doing, you go to all the right movies, all the intelligent stuff, you're operating on a certain rhythm and pace that is comfortable as you get used to it. It's always uncomfortable to get out of that pace and break your routine or your habit. And so to sit still and study something for a week is breaking your habit. And what was your point? And that's painful. And then what was the issue you said?
Awareness. Is it awareness or understanding?
All awareness is seeing what you were doing from another perspective. And so to get out of the flow, you've got to stop. When you stop, it's not necessarily you've gone into a higher awareness zone. You've just begun to look at that other environment from a different perspective, and that will create new patterns, new insights, and it'll give you the sense of expanding your awareness. But you can't stay in that point. You're eventually going to have to get to that point and go look, you experience some other zone and look at those two previous zones through that point. So it's not, there's no finish line in expanding your awareness. So I wouldn't even begin to say that. I would just say that it's tough to change your routine. But it's harder to change your routine since you're living in a world of change. So how can you make change? If everything's always changing, how do we make a real fucking change? So one of the ways is to stop. You know what I mean? Some way, even though it's the hardest thing to do today.
So is that Bob's Mediacology?
Yeah.
Stop?
If that works for a while. If it becomes a habit, then it isn't. You know? But it is... Bob's Mediacology is taking pleasure in the work of looking at one situation through another. So that means you have to have a flexible mind. That means if you like ecology stuff, you got to read right-wing anti ecology literature just to look at that. You know what I mean? Because you become a zombie of one perspective. And then as you learn more and more how any point of view is obsolete, and the society isn't even operating on that point, then you realize, well, geez, I didn't have to learn to live without a point of view. But that's a problem too. But that's why it's so silly to have a point of view when society doesn't even care about that anymore.
Okay.
And that's terrible for society because no one's ever going to get control of the situation or implement real change or implement go in a healthy direction.
It's probably the wrong way to word the question. I was going to say, is it better to do this or this?
No, you can say anything. I don't care about
it. But what I'm wondering is the whole idea of being detached. I guess what I want to ask is to understand something, is it better to be detached from the situation or is it better to be immersed in it?
Okay, that's an eternal dialectic. I can tell you the history of wisdom comes out of that. There was the time school, which through philosophy, monastic living, yoga, you remove yourself from this dimension and you become supremely detached. That's one way. Another way is the space school, where you plunge into society like the Lord Byron and stir up and become a social activist and just cause shit all over the place and justify the turmoil you cause because it gets people out of their routine. So you can withdraw or you can become involved. So that's the dialectic that you're... So that seems to be an eternal thing in humans. Eternal question. It's like, should I stay here and listen to you and accept this interview? I don't want to do it anymore. Suddenly I'm bored. I leave. Or should I suppress my need to leave and get really involved in it? So we're always... That's the drama of cognition, of interrelating with the other. How much do I pay attention to you, therefore not be detached and get involved in your reality, and how much do I ignore you? So that question you're asking is an archetypal oscillation that goes on all the time in consciousness. So, first thing about Bob Mediacology, we become aware of the problem of trying to go one way or the other. Then, Bob Mediacology says, explore one way, and then do the other. And... knowing that it's very hard to really do one or the other because you have a technological environment that allows you to take a choice in these matters. In the old days, you didn't have a fucking choice. You had to make a decision quickly. You know what I mean? Yeah. The tribe's going to war. What are you going to do? You know what I mean? You couldn't listen to 5 albums, read 7 books, subscribe to some magazines, and make a decision in 5 years. So obviously, we're not in that dilemma anymore. But we are. There's never a perfect situation, so we've got new dilemmas. So I like Bob Mediacology describing the new dilemmas we're in, which usually are not describable in these old dialectical terms. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So I like to update people's understanding of the problem they're in, the new way you've got to figure out that ancient problem, whether to get involved or not. So I never read the news. I'm not involved in the news. But I can keep up aware. I can always keep ahead of what the news is saying because I know the larger issues or the issues of the dilemma more.
Okay.
So I can sound more informed than those who read the papers every day. So there's a strategy.
Okay. When I first read the Entertainment Sucks piece in Flipside.
When was that?
Probably about 2 years ago.
After it came out?
Yeah,
came out in 95.
We've Dave got some photocopies out from...
Quite early.
Yes.
Well, not when you get all
96.
The takes.
It might have been a year.
When you get all the takes, that'd be about a year ago.
Okay, about a year ago. The very first thing I kind of got from reading that article, the interview, was I couldn't help but feel at first that everything I'm kind of working towards in my personal life, like playing in a band and all that sort of thing, is completely irrelevant.
That's right. Dave said the same thing. He always gets fucking depressed reading my stuff. And he's just like, what the hell am I doing? Because I've communicated something to him and you that should make, I want to make you stop and scare the shit out of you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, okay. So you got that. But now you're going to say that you reread it.
Well, actually, two questions related specifically to that. Well, first, I was going to say, is that a normal response? And secondly, how do I suddenly not feel irrelevant or something? Or how am I supposed to take that without feeling irrelevant?
It's first, well, if you're lucky, you'll realize that the terms you define yourself in are irrelevant. And I'm threatening your definition, your vocabulary, because my vocabulary kills your inner vocabulary, and then you're stuck there without a way to talk yourself into a new direction. So you should be paralyzed at first, but then if you keep studying me, then you might get a new language, new insights, then motivates you to go somewhere. But I don't know where it's going to be, but I'm like a guy demanding you to leave society, which is harder. It's even more impossible today than it was 100 years ago. So that it is meant to shock you and shake you up and make you feel stupid. Make you feel stupid and depressed. Because I know that this society has so many distractions, you're not going to be stuck there. Maybe 100 years ago I did that to people, they all go nuts. Because there'd be no way of escaping me. But I can't stop you now. There's no way I control your response. So in some ways I have to look more extreme. I go, you're one-fifth neuron, one-fifth astral body. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I have to do that to, sometimes it doesn't work, people don't respond. But since you respond, I want you to feel dead because you've disappeared. And this is why Drove Dave crazy for 10 years. He's all the time he was doing all that, he inspired me. I said, Dave, I don't want you to do that. That's stupid. I kept saying, don't make the fucking album. You're wasting your fucking time doing your goddamn homework and reading LaRouche, you know? And he couldn't do it. He'd read a little bit of LaRouche, but he had to make a living. He liked doing it. So I was always like, it was like assuming that Dave was being immoral and hedonistic. And I was a little bad conscience saying, hey, you're really fucking up here, Dave. You're going to get cancer. You know what I mean? The whole time. And he's making an album which has me on it, and he was thinking, this guy is telling me how to do this, yet it's him. So that was always fun. So you had some of that Dave experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
What year were you born?
64.
So you're 3 years younger than Dave.
Yeah. May 64.
I think it's the same year, same time as Eddie Cooper, very close.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Eddie's the guy to stay with.
Right. So, okay. Well, in relation to the entertainment sex thing as well, are all artists today living under a delusion?
Okay. First of all, everybody's an artist today. Everybody. Even who's the stupidest guy we think of? Even Morris Strong or Hydro. Or even Adam Bond. Because you know why? Because the artist as a concept is obsolete. The artist was a guy who kind of could stand back, look at the patterns of the society, and hold a mirror up to society. It was a small part of society. I mean, not that many people had lived in London in 1850 and went to Gainsborough's paintings, you know what I mean, compared to the mass sum of humanity. But that's our cultural legacy we have here in the West. So that, so then people would learn something from that. So the artist would have a role of getting people to check their involvement in society. Okay, nowadays, and it might frighten people or it might stimulate them. Nowadays, we're so stimulated by information and by machines, movies, media, all the media, they're like machines, they're like artists stimulating us. We don't need an artist in a way. How do you get someone to hold a mirror up to that, like the artist traditionally did? No one artist can do that. So then every person is in the role of an artist. Because basically the artist was someone who was outside of the society, who was almost existential, was able to not believe in the society, take the risk of stepping outside of it in that unfamiliar zone.
Does that create, like, creating an anti-environment?
Right. Okay. Yeah. So the artist traditionally would come along and sort of not believe everything, go through the pain of dealing with that, and then come up with some metaphor to show it back to society, and then it would shock people or whatever, alter, and they'd get an intimation of being outside their culture. The risk-taking that the artist takes of getting out, everybody is in that position today because there's no anthropomorphic scale for humans today. It's all machines talking to machines. So everybody's alienated. Everybody's outside the system, like the artistic view, the artistic consciousness. So therefore, if everybody's an artist, then you can't talk about the guy, the person, the mind that's going to show an anti-environment to the situation, the traditional role of the artist. He cannot use or be part of the artistic artistic vocabulary, since everybody's already that. That's how far gone. So what vocabulary or metaphor can he come up with? You see the problem?
Yeah.
So there's an example of what Bob McCall. I'm showing that your question is you're talking within a vocabulary and you haven't realized that it's not an issue whether you're an artist anymore. Everybody is in the traditional role.
Go for it. Everyone is in the role.
Yeah, I might have missed that. I'll just restate say it again. So everybody's in the position of the artist outside the situation and living in an existential risk-taking situation. We can't depend on anything anymore. Which is really what an artist traditionally did. He got out of the belief, comfort, security, non-risk-taking assumptions and sort of worked from the I-don't-know position and then saw the patterns from that. So everybody's in that just by the fact that today is never going to be the same as tomorrow. And just to wake up, people have to read the news to find out what the rules are today because they change every day in terms of information takeover, turnover. So that the... So the thought was that the art, so that since everybody's experiencing that, and that's cliche, and therefore one cannot, that situation, how are we going to provide slack in that situation? You see, before the artist provided maybe slack if you understood it and got the perspective and got to see the neat pattern. But also that could be frightening because you've been put into the existential position. So everybody's being forced to the existential day. How can you put them into the existential? What is the unfamiliar zone to put people into to create an environment? And basically you can't do that. So the only way, the artistic position of seeing culture as pattern is only done by a rapid series of ersatz innovations. In other words, not one of them, but do a rapid series. And so we have that every day. I mean, the turnover in car styles, music styles, industry styles, anything. All this turnover is a rapid series of innovations. So the machines are doing the role of the artist. They're outdoing the role. So how does the anthropomorphic person get a perspective on that? And that the... I don't know if I'll go into what the first thing is. You got to have something like Finney's Wake to approximate that. Approximates the problem, showing you the problem in book form. It's not a book. It's all media. And it's showing you a rapid series of innovation and shifts. I thought I was going to another pattern, but...
Something to do small AR?
Oh, yeah, there's... Well, small AR... Yeah, that's small art is always the real artistic world of offering perception. New art is always ugly, real small art. The thing that offers perception is not there to make money. The guy's got a problem. The artist has got a problem, and he's trying to figure out something. So he paints it, or he does something traditionally. And then it might be successful, but we know countless people that were heavy artists that no one ever heard of. So small art is not based on commerce, especially today when... The machines need content, and they need shock, and they need that traditional role of the artist, the small art did, that's already inside a commercial monster. So art, the word small art and capital art, what I'm trying to show is what the new small art is, and it's definitely not commercial, but I can't rely on the traditional form of small art, of being non-commercial, because all that gets appropriated. As history has shown, all the dadists are going to make big money out of dadists, or any... fringe person now is Rothman's. It's probably sponsored something about that in retrospect at some point. So the point is that we've disappeared. You know, there's no cultural human fucking artist level of the dealing with this. So the more you deal with that, the more just fucking reacquainting yourself with that question, because you're gonna might get the insight from me tonight. Or from reading after himself, but you're going to forget about it because the mind has to process new stuff. So you just have to keep going back to it and getting stronger at how to see the question. So let me see what the. So I claim though I figured out how to do it, how to be a small artist, and if they could make a capillary out of artist out of it, that's not even an issue. It could, but it doesn't solve the problem we're in. And most famous people, they they end up living in New York because they want to live, and they can be anonymous there and get on with the life doing and learning that they want to do. And they've got a lot of money, so they can afford to live there. There's so many disservices today for people that being rich doesn't protect you from these things. If you're responsible. No, someone could make a lot of money and just be stoned all the time, and they're going to die anyway, so they're not in the game.
Yeah.
So in the world of the game and maintaining awareness, as you said, it's a tougher situation to do, and success doesn't help you. That's why I ended that thing when I said, success, you could be a success and not be a failure. Remember I said that? You actually could pull it off. What?
Yeah.
So.
Are you the only small A artist on the planet?
I'd definitely say yes, but let me just think about it. Let's see if there's some ways of not, I don't want to just assume that. And definitely I'm the only artist, I'm the greatest artist and the only artist alive, because no one else is alive. Nobody's in the position I am in.
Because you're on the outside of it?
I'm more than a small A artist. That's just like page 5 of a 10-page resume. You know what I mean? Besides being a small A artist, I can talk to the dead. I can compose intergalactically. I can cure AIDS. I can do all these things, thanks to Connie in that part. But I have access to amazing realities. So I can't even be defined, It's... can't even be a small artist. So if that's the greatest term within your understanding, your vocabulary of what I am, I am whatever is the greatest thing, plus many other things, Because I want to encourage you to develop into other things as well as just being an artist. Now, I know that you, as a Western kid, are, the last vestige of anthropomorphic prestige is to be an artist. That's our high point today. Because you're not going to be a monk, or you're not going to believe, it's the last dance of the mind, of some kind of superiority complex or something. So that, but I'm always trying to say, hey, there's better things you can get to and aspire to if you got the guts to do it. If you're a real artist, you definitely don't go into the art world. You can sort of drop in every now and then, but there's nothing there, so you can drop in every week and have fun with it, as long as you know that that ain't what you should be doing. As long as you realize you shouldn't spend all your time doing that.
Okay.
Is
there anything that Dave and I can communicate to an audience as musicians? there's no audience, I know.
Okay. The only rationalization is that you want time to do the important things, which is not making music. But if you take time to make music, to give you the money and the slack, to take the time to do the important things, then it's okay to do it. Because everything today is a means to make a living, and everybody has to keep making a living so far. So you can't put down people for the way they make a living. But I always said, Dave, don't be staying up all fucking night working on this album. Don't get so preoccupied and not have a life. And a life means that, doing music is one part of life, but you've got to be other. There's other opportunities to do other things. Like, stop obsessing in that one. You're still specializing. I advocate that you learn to modulate your time you're given to not specialize. But it doesn't mean study all different kinds of music. I mean, be something you're totally not inclined to be. Like study mathematics or something, But not even that. Like, maybe go hang out at a gay bar if you're not gay. Maybe you're, I don't know. You go do, it's like you have to, but then you don't want to. That's a lot of people do that unconsciously. They like new experiences. They'll do anything. Mm-hmm. So you want experience not doing everything. So be by yourself somehow. So
all is that a certain type of dilettantism?
It was, as I was saying, that most people are dilettantes today. They're forced to. You're forced to process. So human beings are very incredibly intelligent and agile, and all artists, super beings, compared to people 100 or 200 or 500 years ago, just because the environment demands it. But it's like the tub, the bathtub, the temperature is getting hotter. It's always up another degree every half hour, but your body's gotten used to it in the previous half hour, so you don't notice it. And all of a sudden, you're roasted to death, and you didn't even notice it, right? So that's what we've done. We've killed ourselves as we become adjusted to incredible demands on our being, and we've adjusted to them well. Okay, so yeah, I'm saying don't be a dilettante, but there are no familiar ways of doing that. The ways to do it would be to interact with the Bob's 10 Holy Offices, or kind of do what Bob does, or get into it, take time to study what Bob studies. That would be the only way to not be a dilettante. And because I'm offering a variety of things, it could look like dilettantism, but I'm saying it's valuable dilettantism, and it's designed to get you to understand how you are being conditioned to be a dilettante. And shouldn't go for that.
Okay. What were you and Dave meaning when you were talking upstairs and you made some point about how...
you were there?
I was there.
Yep.
And you guys were talking about the Lady Di thing or whatever, and you're saying, you know, this isn't the information age. Everyone thinks it's the information
age.
Yeah.
Well, that's another way of saying we've already been saying that. Information is something that gives you a new insight, a new pattern. If we're overindulged with patterns constantly in all forms of information, then you're not getting the real function of information to give you a pattern. That you don't know how to get a pattern that fits you outside of all this overkill of patterns. So that's the same point I've been saying, right?
Okay.
In other words, any word you can come up with, we probably can say that noun is not what's happening. You know what I mean? It's not one noun you can come up with. So if they're all saying, in this world, the old principle, if it works, it's obsolete. If everybody's accepting it, then it probably is not offering perception or anti-environmental awareness or something. Now, another point is that if we get into total, mirror gives you total health and cold fusion gives you economic freedom, then you got to live with the fact that you're kind of immortal. So what are you going to do? And as I said earlier, the souls, when they're on the soul plane, sit around wondering, well, what am I going to reincarnate with this time? It seems that consciousness never gets away from the problem of making decisions. Now, we create this dimension, struggling dimension. Now we've evolved and worked with. We're starting to create an artificial environment here, a technical environment where we're going to have no decisions. We don't have to make any decisions. Or we're going to be kind of having to make it. No, we're going to have the prospect of physical immortality, or the same question we had as a soul. Well, I can do whatever I want to do, so what am I going to do? So we're getting the benefits and disservices of total utopia coming technologically. Like, they're going to say, okay, if you take this pill, even though it won't be that simple, if you do this, you'll live forever. You're going to have to decide, if I'm going to stay in this body forever, now most humans would say, I don't know if there's life after death, but I might be missing out on something if I can't die and go somewhere else. So you're going to have to make a decision.
Yeah.
So the decision-making aspect of the soul, we never can escape. Because even when you're on a soul and you're up there floating around looking at all your lives, you have to make a decision where you want to go next. But probably what assuages that pain of isolation or that strain is dialogue, interaction with others. Seems that ultimately brotherhood, love, interaction is what is spirit. Because that's what people like to do. You know, that's why you forget yourself. By me talking to you, I'm looking at myself through you. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's art right there in the traditional form. So communication is what we're always doing, and that's the essence of being human and maybe all nature. But that's the essence, it's in all dimensions. It's the interaction. Seems to be the way to solve the isolation. So it's like when Jesus said, I am there when any two are gathered in my name. The audience is two people. And you've got Christianity, you've got Slack, you've got Utopia, you've got people interacting.
Okay.
So what was the point, the question?
I was asking about...
Information. So I was just taking that noun and saying, hey, that's not a ground for what we're in. We're in now. We're not in an information age. We're in a non-information age because nothing is informing us. In the sense of, oh, we now have enough facts to make a decision.
Right.
To make an act. Because nobody can make a decision today. Because nobody's listening to the decision and nobody knows which decision to make. So we're in a real quandary.
And everyone's kind of trying to find.
Right. They're trying to. And they're being fooled by the effort to find one. We'll never find one in this situation. So maybe we should turn off information for a while as a collective environment and see what we've been in, what water we've been in.
So is information the ground or no? Or you can't see the ground, right?
Okay, that's a good question. Information, keeping TV going, radio, newspapers, daily life, is propaganda itself. Not the messages within the various media. It's just keeping it going. In other words, Dan rather doesn't say, we got enough facts, we know that we're causing the problem, we're going to stop TV. They know that would be drastically real. You know, that would be real information to do that. And so keeping everything going, not just the content but the form, that is what information is. That's the information age, that propaganda is keeping everything turned on 24 hours a day. That is the ground of our life. Now, we don't have to be merged with the ground. We want to become detached from the ground. So the question is, how do we get detached from it? So you're right to say it's the ground, and it's invisible if you don't understand it. But once you understand that, that it is the ground and how it works on us, and then you realize the bias it creates in us, in the disservice, then you try to, then you say, well, that's what's invisible. What is the anti-environment to that? What's the way of making that visible? So it's not that invisibility is a great characteristic, a great wonderful truth. It's a fact. You know what I mean?
Okay.
It's a figure in the ground. A fact is a relation between what you can see and what is you can't see, the conscious and the unconscious. So the information age is the fact of our time, but it is. The traditional meaning of information is something giving us some semantic meanings or messages. That is only 1/10 of the information age. You know what I mean?
Okay.
That we've lost, that we don't know how to get informed about.
Mm-hmm. Most of it's just clutter.
It's not even clutter. It's just the fact that when you turn on TV and it's still going. See, what freaks anybody out when the fucking system breaks? You know, when my TV doesn't work anymore. You're out of touch.
Yeah.
But that's the real hidden, that's the real factor, is not what's on it, but the fact it's still going. That is the real conditioner.
Okay. I want to sort of go a bit through a little bit of pop music history with you. Just, you know, kind of going chronological, find out sort of some patterns or whatever. I mentioned this to Dave a while ago, and I think he might have mentioned it to you, but I noticed just purely by accident several months ago that within the word television is the word Elvis.
Oh, yeah.
Chronologically.
Yeah.
And I believe you have remember
that,
said that.
That was said, that's been noticed by different people.
Probably.
I've heard that before.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. But it's always a striking thing. No one, I think, noticed that at the time Elvis was happening. You know what I mean? But
yeah, yeah.
We now see the word so... See, almost like... Television was invisible in the 50s. Everybody was into the content. It's only when television becomes an ancient medium into the computer and satellite air that people now see the word and people talk about television. Then they would notice Elvis. You know what I mean?
Right.
Okay.
So basically, I think you said that rock and roll kind of arose out of a new TV language. Is that how you say it? Or?
Yeah. Television was a ground in the 50s. It's a tactile mosaic that had a certain texture. The texture of a TV screen is so different from a flat page. And the texture of the medium is conditioning you, at least subconsciously. So you can obviously see, if you understand that, that the texture of a pulsating medium that's shooting light at you is going to alter the people who use it. And they're going to be different from the people who lived on just reading 150 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. So the texture of television will change the cultural activities in the society that's doing it. So definitely will change music. Now, what's interesting is that rock and roll is the rhythms of hardware factory machines, in a way, in automobiles. I sort of sum that up as radio. So the texture of television made jazz obsolete and speeded up jazz into rock and roll, and the rock and roll had the rhythms of the radio, newspaper, steel ages in it. But because it was the old hidden ground, the old thing that was operating, it now could become pleasure, become entertainment because it was obsolete. So rock and roll is the machine language, the hardware world that the body was being conditioned by for 150 years before. Now they're being conditioned, the bodies are being conditioned by the software pulsating astral language of television, risking saying astral, but I mean something ethereal. So therefore, the past can become a pastime, to quote Finnegan's Wake. So rock and roll is the rhythms of the previous 100 years at fast speed, and it seems pleasurable, especially to the young people who are responding. They're not conditioned so much, so they respond to TV mandate, and then they pick up the music for it. The older generations were conditioned in the hardware age, the radio age. They just, rock was not music. It was pain, because they were not... But 20 years later, those adults were listening to Elvis at their dances in the golf clubs, because they started, by 20, 30 years of TV, 20 years of TV, their collective sensibility was eroded. Their collective resistance was eroded. They were slightly changed. Which shows you how power media is, or television is, because it could change fossilized sensibilities, which you couldn't do in previous societies. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like, they hoik up Native wisdom, Native American wisdom, these old elders who were talking about nature. That wisdom is so inapplicable. So inapplicable to what's going on. They're worse than Nazis, those guys, in terms of their cultural sensibilities to what's happening. Now, that's not totally true, because they do grow up, they do live in today's society. They are mutated. It's just that we want to archetype certain fourth world things, because that resonates with the weird world that TV is making us. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
So that's
Is that kind of why, going back a little bit, is that kind of why rock and roll, I think musically rock and roll was kind of like the first art form or whatever to sort of encompass everything that had come before, musically. Whereas jazz really seems like, jazz, which I guess is radio era. Or
right.
Really,
what do you mean encompass everything? You're on the right
track. Encompass everything in terms even just like of musical structure and form. Like rock and roll kind of took, like, well, as you say, the rhythms of the machinery or whatever.
Plus natural rhythms, you know, pastoral rhythms.
Yeah, and eventually, like, even, like, and I'll get into some of the different, like, specific genres, but eventually, like, you know, encompassed, like, classical music, jazz.
Oh, but so you're talking 20 years after Elvis.
Yeah, I mean, even, I wonder, like, now, even the Beatles, though,
right.
Sort of, like, encompassed
were,
a bit of everything.
Yeah, the Beatles were more group mind, cultural encyclopedias more than Elvis. Because they were, first of all, they were a group. No, it was a group mind. Which was the new trio, that's an important thing. Since all media are contained within television, see, television is the last medium. It includes all the various stages. They had to invent the book, they had to create science, they had to get steel, they had to make metal, then they had to make electricity. All that is contained in the TV experience. You know what I mean? It's a mythic thing that contains a historical legacy of people creating 200 to 500 years of environments to make that possible. So the music of that would contain all that stuff. So certainly the music in the TV age, echoing the TV fact, would include all cultural rhythms and consume the whole world of sound, because on top of that, rock and roll is not just music, especially with TV. It's body language, it's dance, it is youth project, it's an environment that... First of all, you couldn't see the jazz guys. But when young kids could see a young person doing that, that's a revolution in itself. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so you incorporate, you involve more people of the society, more of the range realm, you can get all the young people. So therefore, it's an environment, they project all their youthful fantasies in it, and it's not just a voice singing. It's not just a body dancing. It's mixed media. So therefore, it's not music. It's an environment.
Okay, and did you once say something like, I think you said this, rock and roll is speech slowed down or something?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What's that?
No, music.
For music.
Yeah. Song is speech slowed down or altered, because what you find is that... you can go through the history of music the last 500 years, and you can say you take the time of windmills. When windmills came in, any musicologist knows the music that was popular in the courts before that, and then the music changes, and they would start, they probably, if they were smart, they'd notice in retrospect that the rhythms of the windmills, which was a new technological environment, caused a change in the rhythms of the music. Because music is a language, it responds to the cultural languages that already make up the society that invents the music, and any new cultural media or language that come in affect the particular language of music. So, since the medium of a simple society that has speech, that's the ground, the medium they operate in and all that it does, the anti-environment of that would be to take that ground and alter it. And music is a way of altering it. Generally, you know, in the pastoral images of music, it's slowing down. Some god is singing about the birds, whereas the citizens talk, 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 and then come, what is it, Julia Andrews, you know, or somebody. It's taking the, remember, this is primitive people, primitive societies compared to our complex, sophisticated sensibilities. And so someone talking slowly with a beautiful voice and lilting, that creates attention. And it's an anti-environment temporarily. So, but Then you could say, then someone could do a song, could sing faster. But by general simple statement, all music is speech slowed down. But if you want to get particular, if someone smart enough asked me to clarify that, then I could make it. So I made the statement originally just to get attention. But it's a truth, but it's subject to modulation if you want to get into particulars. So, see, the reason Chinese like Chinese music, and this is up till 1960, and other cultures didn't like it, their language wasn't like Chinese language, their spoken language, and the rhythms of Chinese music respond as an environment to the rhythms of the Chinese speech. So you see how music would be culturally specific, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But nowadays, we're into a discarded, electrified situation. We can't even use cultural definitions. And that's been the case for a long time. So,
what you're saying is, so music is...
So you understand, I guess, what I'm saying is that music is speech slowed down, mm-hmm. or it could be altered any way, speeded up. But it's definitely... but then when you brought in the book, the printed book allowed people to split song from the instrument, and they could develop intricate instrumentation via the printed page, and that split off traditional song from the instrument. And then you got classical music. That was part of the fragmentation of the Gutenberg effect.
Okay.
Then electric environment brought that, re-imploded things. So now anybody, like Johnny Lydon, anybody could do what Johnny Lydon if they had the equipment to make all these sounds. So the idea of a musician as an artist doesn't apply anymore. But you still got to have somebody... We don't know what qualities make someone talented to make a sparkling, synthesized song that everybody responds to. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Does Frank talk at all about... I noticed you had one question, or there was a question in there, something about, you know, what's the next thing going to happen?
Yeah, he talks about it.
What does he say?
Well, we have to
explain it again. Okay.
It's, he says,
we don't have to worry about it. Yeah, I'll go for it.
Yeah, no problem. But when you read it, you'll notice there's lots of time. Like, in the end, Zappa was working from the principle of the technology altered music, and he was dealing with that in simple McLuhan terms. He was dealing with that. That's what makes that interesting. That's what we're talking about is what he was dealing with.
Okay. Now I want to get into some specific things regarding that essay in a little bit.
So we're doing the chronology.
Yeah, so Elvis and the Beatles.
Have you seen my perfect pitch chart, Dave?
No, I used to have the High Weirdness by Mail, but was that the one that's in High Weirdness by Mail?
Yeah, because it has, you see, Elvis was radio. Then the Beatles were black and white TV as art form. They were, the content was black and white, and psychedelia was the effect of color TV because they were moving into computer and satellite. So therefore, TV was already rearview mirror and art form and pastime. But there was two kinds of TV: black and white, and psychedelia and color TV.
Mm-hmm.
So they were technologies that altered the music. All of a sudden, people wanted to take drugs and listen to screeching Janis Joplin or something. And the electrified... There was also the novelty of having electrified music and with new gadgets that altered it. There's always the pure perceptual novelty fact that people respond to. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. Elvis and the Beatles, they're often written about and romanticized as pop explosions. But after the Beatles, it seems, the audience... became more and more fragmented, like the late 60s, early 70s. And that particular kind of music explosion where... I could be wrong with this. While writing the question, I couldn't decide if this was completely wrong.
Well, the key is FM radio. FM radio broke people...
Fragmented the audience.
Yes, because it was a technology that came in. Before that, it was AM radio, and then Sullivan. And that was all people had.
Mm-hmm.
Once you brought in... automation and decentralization, FM radio, and then cable with your ship-to-shore communication, then you didn't have the impact of, you didn't have consciousness unified anymore. So you could, the idea that they were explosions, can you say that the explosions got any less later? It just wasn't registered on a standard meter anymore.
Okay, well I guess, yeah, because I was going to, the example I was going to use, like, for instance, Nirvana and grunge. Mm-hmm. In one particular way, it was kind of an explosion. At the same time, it was an explosion to a very fragmented audience. Like, that grunge could not cross over to reach black kids, for instance. I mean, not by and large. And you know, no parents allowed, absolutely.
Right.
Whereas the Beatles obviously transcended that, although maybe that's just over time. Same with Elvis.
It was over time. The Beatles were controversial at the very beginning, and even for some kids, they didn't like the Beatles when they went psychedelic. You know what I mean? You see, like, I think it's impossible to measure any of these things once you get by the middle 60s, and that advertising ratings are all fake. It's like Big Brother. That's the Big Brother. It's not a guy running a police state and killing political rebels. The police state is the Nielsen ratings, because it's a fake standard to create some kind of communal coherence in this information overload. And what was I saying? So the ratings. So after what was I saying? Crossing over
the Beatles.
So you couldn't say what happened in 67 when the Beatles did what they did, other than what Dick Clark wanted to show you. They showed a bunch of kids, a few 25 kids, not like Ian, and 25 said, there was millions of people who were doing all kinds of things, even old people responding to it. The camera, that, you know, Big Brother's eye, can't show every fucking response among the population. That's why it's like, this planet is like billions and billions of stars. There's billions and millions of people getting experiences from different media that can't be measured. And Croker's very good, and Baudrillard talked about that. Most of social mass is invisible and unregistered, not ever noticed. There's revolutions and whatever, group explosions going on all over the place, in living rooms or wherever, in other parts of the world, that aren't registered. And that's why we're doing more and more with less and less. You know, it's
okay.
That's what I mean.
Okay.
It's like, it's almost like you see logically the technology blows. You're going to have one guy, the Antichrist, is going to be sitting there, and he's, I like Elvis, so wherever you're going to have to listen to Elvis. But the breakthrough of electric decentralization is, that might be projected on one band, but you're not going to stop millions of people listening to their old 8-tracks or whatever they're listening. How can you stop it? The only way to stop it is to raise the rent so high that you're starving, and you got no jobs, and you're fucking dying. Yeah. Then you bring back social uniformity. But as long as we keep people generally healthy, you can't control the multi-conscious people experience and time warps and all the media they consume.
So you
would not been able to measure the effect of disco or whatever, the new wave, punk, none of it. That's why it's always looking like it's reviving. It's not reviving. That's just group minds coming through and are still into it, or just discovered it.
Okay.
That's where all time's happening. It's beyond Einstein. It's beyond what I was saying with the evergreen. We are physically redoing the ant watching us live. We have physically recreated the soul dimension here in terms of information simultaneity. And no linearity going on.
Okay. In regards to punk, which you just mentioned, how does punk, which it's kind of like, you know, symbolic year or whatever, is 1977, and you said that's when everything basically is.
Yeah, that's when the Big Brother couldn't fucking measure things anymore. You know what I mean? The Nielsen ratings, advertising was the holding, the pulser guys, and it couldn't fucking measure it anymore. So Reagan and them just came in the 80s, was, we're just going to pretend we're Americans and we have a model, it's a movie and it's a hologram and you adjust to it. And some people had to, depending on their employment situation, others didn't even care. Mm-hmm. I mean, the anarchy that people think happened in the 60s just carried on and never stopped.
Okay.
I mean, there are more drug addicts and perversions and whatever value standards you want to make about what's going on now than there ever was.
Right.
I mean, no social program that tried to offer some balance or ecological corrective in the 60s was ever successful.
Camille Paglia says something like, the I don't know if she says the values of the 60s, she says they're kind of being retrieved now, like it was lost. Is that...
Well, see, yeah, that's silly. I mean, she only looked attractive because... If you talk about media, which is approximating the ground, you look like a revolutionary. Mm-hmm. But what she says, anybody, as David said, read entertainment stock, I clarify the issues way better than she does. Mm-hmm. And she, and many people notice she's kind of leaning into McLuhan land, and they'll say, well, you sound like McLuhan. And says, oh, yeah, I like McLuhan, but you can't say anything about it.
Yeah,
you can't
be
accurate.
That,
you know what I mean? She
just said, I'm a bigot here in McLuhan, and she hasn't said a thing about what he's actually
And she's
did.
Not a bit, she doesn't even know how she could use McLuhan to make her argument better that she's talking about.
Yeah.
But she really, she's a whole syndrome of complex reactions. basically, many baby boomer women who went through feminism that know those images don't last anymore. They're looking for new images. And she came up with a temporary image that at least acknowledged that the old images were obsolete. And since people are mutating every 6 months in information pattern sense of the selves, the paradigms they have, anybody who comes up and offers a corrective to that or says the old image is right, they'll immediately get a response. And that's only a tiny response. I mean, a bestseller in Canadian literature is a guy writes a novel or a woman and sells 1,400. That's considered a fucking bestseller. Now, that's puny. That's so tiny. But the industry needs that to keep their money turnover bullshit. Or I don't know. We don't even know. I don't think. See, everybody's on welfare. You know what I mean? As long as we keep having money as a guaranteed environment and some kind of social security, well, everybody's on welfare. It's just different ways you act out the broke spiral of the level you want to live on.
Right.
Because an executive, they have a very poverty-stricken life. They've got to run around dealing with their businesses and playing golf and talking on one topic, how to keep the hologram of the company going, while their son is home listening, watching hours of TV, watching this and that, fucking everybody, whatever they're doing, playing ball hockey 5 days a week, all this free time, and they're having more variety and living experience than their father. You know what I mean? And they probably don't even have a father anymore.
Yeah.
So the to be any socially functional role, to maintain all the old institutions, means that you're highly specialized to do that. And an average woman or person on welfare, just the amount of stuff they take in and can do while on welfare is, they're taking a lot of experience. They're watching TV or radio or walking around. Now, the fact they don't understand this, they don't have a language to define it, makes them very unhappy. They don't know what I'm describing. They don't know they're in a state of slack. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They want to, actually it's comfortable to like the Evergreens, like they say, to dive into this limited, unpredictable dimension. That's like diving in. Give me a job so I can have one thing to do and I don't have to have all these choices to make. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's all upside down. People want to become stupid, dumber by getting a good job. So they can have something to do so they don't have to take everything in.
Yeah, something to hang on to.
Right, and also have a sense of community, because there's no community. We're all astronauts. We're all satellites floating around, and the person on welfare is an astronaut, and there's no way to connect to anybody. So that isolation, that inhuman isolation, affects a person more who's not working. Because when you're working, you at least got to do something, and people are forced to talk to you, so you have a sense of community, which is the ultimate universal anesthetic, because you're having dialogue with people, and that's what makes you human. You know what I mean?
Okay. Go back a little bit to the 1977 thing. I'm interested in the idea that punk rock and the Sex Pistols and Malcolm McLaren and all that was kind of like, in some ways, well, there are some precedents, but in some ways it was the first like directly confrontational stance with the audience.
Yeah.
What's that?
Well, the hippies were the first to come out and confront the audience by not dressing up in industry standard Beatle kind of stuff, right? You mean, you know, having uniforms and looking the same. So the casualness of the hippies was the first confrontation. Now, the audience didn't find it, well, a lot of people hated it. They never liked hippie music, never will. But the people, especially the younger people, college people, whoever got into it, they were responding to the environment. And the environment had all kinds of implications, including the values of community, love, and brotherhood, which came up for other reasons. So the hippies were indifferent and confront the audience, but they had a cover. They had a nice ideology of, hey, we're doing this for brotherhood, you know what I mean, or sisterhood, or for community, to bring back human scale. Mm-hmm. Okay, by the early 70s, everybody realized there was no community possible because that fragmented the whole hippie revolution, all right? So you have that bland early 70s period where everything's dead and nothing's happening. And
it's interesting to fragment the going.
Oh, yeah, good, yeah. And so then you have the Generation X grows up. The punks grow up as children of the hippies, or just a little bit younger brothers and sisters. All they did was repeat the confronting of the audience that the hippies were doing, but since they now knew, and everybody knew there was no community, they could be blatant about it and put out anti-community symbols like Nazi swastikas and that, and it would be entertainment. It actually would create a sense of community for the young kids. See, so that was the point, that no stance you take to stick it up the nose of somebody, as Frank said, to be through the medium, because there's always going to, there's a whole sensibility, collectivity that's forming that, hey, you're right, it's exactly like Life of Brian. He goes, he says, he looks at the way, he says, stop following me, I teach it, you follow yourself, follow your own self. And they all go, yeah, that's right, follow our own selves. And it's a group mind responding, you know, so you can't avoid the group mind response. So that confused Johnny Rotten and the whole punk movement for a while. Mm-hmm. So they tried to just get more cynical, spit on the audience, but it never worked because they didn't know that the population of mind already knew there was no community, and they actually welcomed abuse value. So that is that's one way to begin to explain it. Any of these things you bring up, if you have any questions, that's natural. If I don't complete it. Because it takes a lot of talking, of covering all the factors that could be involved in this. You know what I mean?
Well, just what you said there about abuse value, actually, one of the other writers I interviewed, Frank Cogan, he had a good, I thought it was an excellent comment. He said, going back to the Rolling Stones, he said, they found an audience by saying, and get off my cloud, don't hang around, because she's a crowd. Is that kind of along the lines of what you're saying? Or?
Like, well, that definitely, here's the thing, you have the Beatles, the Stones are definitely, remember, you know, start getting into my chart, and there's no human scale since 1900 or something. Yeah, there's no humans. The machines have been running the 20th century. So, the reason that the hippie culture in the 60s counter-revolution happened is that you were getting into automation and satellites. The people were responding to the ground of automation and satellite, which gave people electric economy. There was no community control anymore. So you could spit in the face of any community. You couldn't do that before World War II, because even though there was no community anymore, you didn't have the technological ground to escape from the community. Okay? Okay. So fascism could still come in and impose something, but you couldn't have that kind of control over people when they started having just the wealth of the 60s and the fragmentation of the computer environment, automation, and the whole cultural matrix. So the Beatles... they come on, and let's see, what, there's a million responses to them by different demographics, but definitely the Stones were like the dark side, even though you can't limit to a yin-yang, yang-yin dialectic, but just for purpose of this conversation, mm-hmm. they were telling the truth that there was no community, and we could spit in the face. And Dylan was kind of in between the Beatles and them. He went both ways, blowing in the wind, and retrieve community, but also you dissolution rope and he yeah. spit on you. Yeah. So he was friends of both of them. He's in the interval. So the thing is, the important thing is that the Beatles and the Stones, one representing community, the other anti-community, all still believed that it was valuable to say one or the other. They didn't know nobody was listening. And that's why when you have the replay of the 60s by a punk, which having aspects of the definitely the beat of the Stones, and then the later developments before the punks, all getting more aggressive, you know, MC5, you can work your way through, Lou Reed, Iggy Pop, there's all these more and more violent things, all saying fuck you to the world and to community. By the time the punks come along, they know that it's not even significant to say there's no community. And so that's why Malcolm McDowell and the Great Rock and Roll Swindle begin saying, I want to make clothes. I want to sell clothes. So I want to do marketing. And he knew that you could market negativity to the young kids because they already knew negativity was a value. Having no value was a value. And that was the last value of to say that everything that was good in the 60s was obsolete. That was like the last pattern for a young kid to identify with and get identity from. The kid would have to later wake up the fact that wasn't even fucking relevant to point out that no values was significant. You know what I mean?
Okay. So
you see the pattern? I'm always pushing it further than your assumptions. Right?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Because I want you to realize that's how fucking far gone it's been for 100 years. You know what I mean? That's what we got to realize. We don't realize the massive effect. I mean, McLuhan cried when the satellites started to happen. He knew it was all over because we had extended the planet. We extended beyond our individual senses. That was a huge ending of humanity.
Wow.
Wow. and everything becomes even worse than a cartoon. They become electronic cartoons, what I call the quarktoon. You know, Mr. Trudeau gets up and says, well, we must preserve this or that. This is, first of all, he's speaking English. Doesn't exist anymore. He's pretending that there's someone listening to him. Mm-hmm. See, so it's all a mirage to hide the fact that there's nothing there anymore.
Okay.
So now you know why kids or everybody goes and takes drugs. I mean, this is a horrible situation. And the drug thing has increased more and more and more and more. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, if you could take Spencer Tracy in 1935 and show him America in 1997, guy would have had a heart attack immediately, probably. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, he was a wild guy for his time, and not necessarily in the movies, but he lived in the Hollywood dream world, you know? So that's how far gone we've gone.
Okay.
Yeah.
This question, actually, just in light of what you say, sounds like incredibly naive.
Yeah, no matter what you say, it's going to be naive. You see, there's a great line about Eliot. He has a character in his poem saying, I've got to use words when I talk to you. That's a problem. You got to use words because we agreed to. But words are important, but you have to realize, it's like, first there's a mountain, then there's no mountain, then there is a mountain, that's the end thing. First there's language, then you got to realize, there ain't no language, then you learn how to use language knowing the context you're in.
Okay.
So I tolerate this stupid question. Okay.
was disco kind of like the, I don't know, what was that like the hedonistic sort of flip of punk or?
No, I got a really good thing on disco.
Okay, actually, we'll hold it because I think this is just about going to end. I want to get that.
How's the time? Have you got a watch?
I'll find out.
Yeah, just so we get a sense of, must be at least 10?
It's about 10:30.
Okay, so maybe, I don't know, go for half an hour anymore.
Yeah, that's probably about in line with what I've got anyway, so.
You're actually getting near the end? Now here's the thing about the satellite goes up in 57, and then if you read up the Orfagandi, the satellite environment disappears in 67, and then there's no framework. That's the last extension, so everything is flux and flow. And so from 67 on, everybody's on drugs. Like it's like that. All the media, the animal machines are interacting and flowing, and there's no framework. The framework before that was, there was radio, then TV, there was a chronological order of evolution of technology. But when the satellite was the extension of the planet in 57, and that becomes environment by 67, then it collapses. It supersedes itself because of the chip, the computer chip, which can do everything, contain everything, and it becomes a new medium. So from 67 to 77, the satellite has no longer, we're no longer rotating around the planet in the satellite position. So by 77, 10 years of no satellite is ground. The popular culture can begin to become aware of that. And when you get into 77 and beyond 77, even what I call the native land or after image of post-satellite from 67 to 77, when it's chips happening, organizing media in the 70s, that is all an after image of, or the astral body after image of the satellite environment. The satellite was the end. When that ended in 67, then there's nothing after that because you completed the cycle, technological cycle. So all there is an after image. So the after image goes to 77. After 77, there's not even any after image, so definitely nothing exists anymore. In machine communicable forms exist. So what would be the last strategy of the human electrons, subatomic particles, would be to dance around the satellite. And what the fuck is it, the disco ball? This fucking satellite, isn't that amazing?
That is.
With the laser beams coming out of it. So that's a good, that explains the whole thing. And so that was disco. Probably was stronger than punk. Punk definitely was the anti-environment. You have the the statement and the response. And disco's coming along. Punk is responding to its parents' music as well as disco. They go hand in hand. The culture needs both because if there is a struggle going on, then that makes reality, the machine, say, yeah, there's still something there. So the punk stimulate disco. This is a postmodern insight that challenge. That the authorities give out challenges and you respond. They're playing their game by responding and arguing about what they challenge you with. And so disco was a challenge when punk responded, and that struggle of trying to define the turf kept the illusion going. But I would say that the image, you could say the satellite, you could say disco was definitely the satellite environment as entertainment, pastime as pastime. And the punk, since they were clothing, they probably represent the raw energy of the chip, of a new chip coming in and organizing the automation and the whole circuitry of society for that year's cultural products. And you, and you know, Windows 95 is like a new chip, right? And that was happening before Windows. So punk is a chip. It's a the Rumpelstiltskin chip that comes in and alters the situation. If you want to suppose the disco is half the environment and punk is the other, we could say that punk is not chip if you want to just say that punk is responding to the real ground, which is the satellite display time, and just being the natural negative response to it.
Okay.
You know, there's always two sides to a story, right? So punk and the disco are two sides to the fact that satellite is gone and now an entertaining symbol of a past time. And especially you look at my chart, they have laser beam on behind the orbit. The satellite laser beam coming together, and that's the disco thing. It's the satellite ball, and it's these lights coming out like laser beams.
Okay.
You see that in Up the Orpigani? Where's Up the Orpigani? It should be a chart right at the end. They just go to the last page. You see?
Oh, yeah.
You see?
Where's that laser beam?
Yeah, see? Now that is. That is 45 to 60 is when it was actually being built. By 77, it disappeared by 67. By 77, it is a holopathic cliche probe of the satellite environment and the laser beam.
Okay.
See, this is a good chart. This should be taught in all courses, from music to physics, because I'm talking the ground. So you could use this in a music pop culture history thing. If you knew some of these, if you knew about disco ball.
Yeah.
See, isn't that obvious? But you never thought of it, but it's obviously a fucking satellite. And it's dancing around it.
Yeah.
Sort of outside, they've gone past it and extended beyond the satellite environment into chip land. They're for just little electrons on a chip pattern in a circuit. So, in all media, all the machines become that. So.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Pop nowadays, pop music, generally.
No, just take that phrase, pop music. That's everything.
Okay.
Since everything is
okay.
The chip, Windows 97 is pop music because everything is musical today. Everything translates a seamless web. It's just that the particular tools of making guitars or whatever seems like music, that keeps the mythic stage of the discipline of what's called music. But it's just a little electron in relation to all the other electrons and it's working as a seamless dance. So the whole society is pop music. Anyway,
okay. Well, actually, we'll talk a little bit about this. As I wanted to get into.
No, let's go back to the question.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. The question I had worded was
because I can say things that will spin you off another.
Yeah. Okay.
But let's just go through the question.
Okay. Pop music nowadays seems little more than a retrieval of previous musics, be it in the form of digital sampling, the lounge revival. Or people's fascination with the 70s and 80s. You talked a little bit about those.
Okay, the immediate answer to that, retrieval. Since everything disappeared by 77, there's nothing new created from 77 to 90 except for Bob and Connie.
Yeah.
There's nothing new created, so you could do more with less, you can do more, and you have to keep retrieving. So that's why as we get further along in the 20th century, everything more and more does seem retrieval because there hasn't been anything new for a long time. Even though a lot of what was new was a retrieval. But this, what's driving people crazy is that that's becoming obvious that there's no more way to make new. So what do you do to make new? You do less. You say you put Clinton in every fucking movie. That's pretty outrageous. You know what I mean? But you're doing less, but you create a sense of novelty.
Okay.
And that's the only thing to counter the sense of endless retrievals.
Okay. That, I'm a little confused.
Okay. Yeah, but you should be, because how can you understand totally what I'm saying? You can't understand. I'm including information that you're not aware of. You know what I mean? You haven't had time to study. I've got a whole fucking paragraph going through my head that I'm just referring to.
Okay, we'll talk about a bit about.
Can we go back to your question? I keep interrupting your question.
Yeah, that's okay. Talk a bit about digital sampling, which is an actual technology.
That's chip running the fucking music. That's chip. Rumpelstiltskin the chip. And you're just, the chip is making the music for you. It's providing all the, now the sampler, the sampler is a good word because that's what people live. Once you had the electric autonomy of your answering machines, your personal computer, your cellular phones, you're this floating subatomic particle who is experiencing endless variety of media, image, sound and sight and feeling. and you just sampling the remote control. So sampler music comes in with the same time as the remote zapper. So the music changes under the new technology, remote zapping in the 80s. So then the music becomes a form that mimes the latest technology. So it becomes sampling music. So luckily, you had the chip to make both possible. If you didn't have a chip, you couldn't do this. You know what I mean? You couldn't have the satellite providing all those channels. And if you didn't have the chip, you couldn't make a sampler. So obviously, the ground is the chip, and the particular cultural texture is the remote experience. So sampling is, this just chart is a sample. It's different. Oh, epochs, the other version, the word soul of theater. If you look at the bottom there, the chart on the left. The very bottom is the soul of theater. Page 2, just flip it over. It's the last page. That's from 16 to 90. This is an average kid today lives between 60 and 90. With all the, they get that on TV. There's always replays going on all media. They get it in school. This is the mind of the average kid today. And they get endless chip retrieval. Their little chip retrieves all this stuff. Rumpelstiltskin. They can see images of JFK, Watergate, McCarthy, Johnny Rotten, Patsy Cline. All this is in their environment, and depending on the time or circumstances, they can consciously input it. So this sampling is something definitely people experience in their cultural overload every day.
Okay.
So music always responds to the new unconscious needs that people go through. Now, usually the younger people respond faster because they're more plastic. They're more malleable because they haven't got any fossilized patterns yet. And that's why older people think, Sam, what the fuck is that? You know, give me Elvis. So every time a new technology comes in, it reinforces retrievals and nostalgia for older fragments of society, or for not 60-year-olds, but 25-year-olds compared to a 15-year-old. So right now you have all this new stuff happening. You got retrievals of 70s for people who grew up in that period. You got retrievals of 80s for people who grew up in that period. You got retrievals of 60s, 50s, 40s. It's constantly all times happening at the same time.
Okay.
So sampling is just, you can always just go back. It fucking summer came on. Ed Sullivan and played sampler music. Everybody laughed their fucking heads off. They think the guy's a nut. It's Spike Jones or something, right?
Yeah.
Because there's not technological mutation that conditioned them to accept it. That's what, if you start looking at it, and we can do that more in the 20th century, it's always, you will get amazed at what people think is entertaining compared to what people thought was entertaining 100 years ago or 50 years ago. That's always an interesting sideshow of how humans create culture. So to ask me, what do I think about it? You know, you ask me what I think. Well, it's a mandated environment which creates mandated music. It's like robots. Bring in a new technology, changes the music. I mean, you could say that the reason rap came in, which is in the early phases, speech-based. Once we had all disappeared and technologies all disappeared, we were back to cavemen. We're all living in a little room, and we just arrived, and we talked to each other. That's our first medium. So entertainment became based on talk, because we had superseded the whole cycle, the historical cycle of evolution, technological evolution, flipped ourselves to the ultimate extreme, where we extended the planet, and then we end up crashed back at the fireplace. And in a lot of ways, that disappearance for the 80s, for in the ghettos, they had nothing. They had no money, so they just were fucking scratched, you know what I mean? But that was their technological present, which was actually post-technology. So you can see why speech, that's why I have rap rant, you know, from 72 to 76. Rap rant is the last phase.
72 at that time.
Yeah. And that's why Bob's a great musician, and I'm a rapper, I'm a ranter, but I do it with the causes, not just the effects. And but you see, I mean, you know, for someone, always remember, someone could not do what rap did in 1990 in 1955. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's really funny that when you think, especially in the 20th century, which has these changes go faster, literally, Spencer Tracy, if was suddenly plunked down today, he would think that Hitler won the war or something. Whatever horrifying image. Because all of America was drug addicts and people yelling at each other, and they thought it was entertainment. That's how crazy you would see. Because this guy, he's dancing in ballrooms, he likes a little swing band jazz or whatever, but this is a courtly, elite lifestyle, a cloister cocoon, you know what I mean?
Is there anything taboo, entertainment-wise?
Why would there be? we need as much content as possible. You got a lot of airtime. They got 500 channels, which we're probably never going to get. We'll get the. See, what's interesting? We're not really in an information overload because there's always millions of people who will look at something. It's just that you can't control it in money terms. We have more wealth than you can measure. We are all trillionaires. We are all trillionaires in terms of information that services environments provided for you. Incredible things that are provided for you compared to what people had 100 years ago. But you cannot put that back into accounting terms. We're not trillionaires, each one of us, in visual gold standard money, visual space terms. But you can't measure things by visual space anymore. But the Antichrist is a guy still insisting on visual space, which we call the IMF and the bankers, you know what I mean? They insist in keeping their medium going. Now, they have a right to do that, but you can't get people together to clarify the issues, to say, well, hey, wait a minute, you know, we are all wealthy, and we have all this stuff, and we can't use money to mention that anymore. So what are we going to do? You know, are we going to put everybody on a guaranteed income, or what? And I think that's such a problem, because that's really a way of dealing with the fact we all disappeared. There's nothing taboo, there's no measurement. See what I mean? There's no way to, you don't have a gold standard and then the bad. You don't have the good and the bad. You know, this is acceptable, that's taboo. There's no way to measure those. It's just so puny, that dialectic, compared to the fact that you can take in so much stuff and on whatever level.
Okay. How does that tie in with the idea, going back to what I'm calling the retrieval of these older forms, like now you've got the kind of lounge revival. Right. Suddenly, Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin. The cigars are the most rebellious things.
Now, here's you. You're old enough now that you're going through the Spencer Tracy. You never thought they'd fucking retrieve Frank Sinatra. That would never fucking happen. We knew that fucked up real bad. You know what I mean? So you're even getting it now, right?
Yeah.
They're just constantly ransacking culture or anything to provide entertainment because there's always new people who are 18 years old and got to go to the senior prom and they got to be different from last year, so they're going to ransack anything to create a hologram that they claim we're different from last year. So eventually they're going to go to the prom, wearing chartered accountant suits or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're wearing accounting books. Like, this is the thing. They're all masks. They're all masks for identity.
Is it retreat as camp?
Yeah, camp. Camp gives people a sense of reality because it gives a replay of their lives. We actually don't have replay anymore. All of business is based on replay. All of culture is replay because if everything's disappeared, there's nothing to replay. So an after image of becoming something still here is to at least replay what used to be here. That's why everything became camp. And that is only one aspect. There's three aspects to nostalgia. There's camp. There's archetypal retrieval, and there's holopathic cliché. There's archetypal process, the cliché process, and nostalgia, which is camp. No, in camp. Nostalgia is in three parts. The archetypal thing, which is the other chart. See, remember the title is... right here. Yeah, that one says, how the media archetypes fit the Battle of Jericho. Okay, there's the archetypes. Then the Antivirement II archetypes, and these are holopathic archetypes in 1990. The holopathic opposite is a cliche probe, and this chart is holopathic cliche probes, it says up there in tiny print. Cyclotron of holopathic cliche probes. So those are the main formal processes. This is content, this is form, and camp is pop culture and blatant content, nostalgia, rearview mirror, conservative stubbornness of the human being. Because these are the machines, the cliche probe machine fighting the archetype machine. The human scale, which ain't there, is walling around in camp.
Okay.
And camp is putting something in quotes.
Yeah, okay. Is that the same thing as irony?
Yep, irony is putting everything in quotes.
And is everyone ironic? I mean, well, everything is ironic.
Yeah, they have to be ironic because since you're translated into another form immediately via different media, then you are living the life of a speeded up artist who's aware of a situation. That's why awareness is obsolete, comprehensive awareness. So visionary awareness is obsolete because we are already in that thing, and the average Joe can be ironic because he's put through so many changes, which leads to an ironic stance.
Okay.
Which is like extreme self-consciousness. In other words, let me repeat what I was about to say kind of experience. Everybody hears everything so rapidly within a few years. It's just somebody listening to talk shows for 5 years, they hear every fucking human opinion that ever could be said on anything. You know what I mean? And then you get familiar, and then at the same time they can watch Saturday Night Live and get humorous replays on it, or cartoons, or anything. It's in a massive classroom we live in, where our sensibility is making us super sophisticated, super civilized, super ironic subatomic particles.
Okay.
We're both.
Okay. In terms of dance music, dance culture, whatever, it's, you know, it seems like it's constantly kind of chopping itself up and speeding up. And now you've got jungle music, which is like 170 beats per minute, as opposed to, you know, disco and house, which are like 125, 130 right. beats per minute. What's that? Is that speed up? Is that a technological? Is that just part of
okay. the... Remember, we're in the most primitive... This is so extraordinary our time that you have to think of the most primitive, harshest conditions and the most advanced utopian conditions, and both happening in our time, and we're even going beyond that. So in that situation, you take the Eskimos. They had 50 or more words for snow. When we go up there, we just see snow. But they live in that environment, they can see all the differences. There's 50 kinds of snow. Well, when a teenager or a young person grows up in acoustic space, in simple terms, electrified, all this music, ear bombardment, and body language and dancing, they can see all the different kinds. It's all snow to someone who's older. But there's 50 kinds of snow for the the consumer. So you can look up any zine magazine, and often they'll chart out all the different demographics of tiny, minute group minds. That's relevant to the average teen Eskimo who sees 50 kinds of snow. And the differences you're making to me just seem like 50 kinds of snow. Now, they're all important for each faction. And this is not possible without the technology. So is your question, is that fragmentation due to technology? Is that
just the speed up of dance, the speed up of the tempo speed.
But see, musically. Here's the thing. The point I'm making is all these things, we're robots and we're technologically conditioned. You probably think machines are this mechanical, inorganic thing. But when you realize that they're alive and interacting with earlier machines, speech being an earlier machine, then you see how organic machines are and why people, that is the cause in all these things. It's a very simple cause. Now, this might stop thought if you, well, I know why, whatever, the brand new technology is going to change it. If you understand that pattern, what are you going to think with? That might threaten the mind. It seems to me that I'm repeating and saying the same answer to every question you're saying, but it's such an all-encompassing answer that you still have to repeat and think about it for the next 6 months and try to find examples to see all the, like the disco ball, all the flashing little segments, crystal segments on the ball, all showing you that it is a ball. You know what I mean? And so you're looking at all the aspects. I'm saying that I can only give you the same answer to that question, but let's try to come with a different answer. I'll try not to say that answer, because what's interesting is that you can't see the answer. You can see why it's not a stupid question, but you know the answer to the question if you've been listening to me for 2 hours,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So restate, now saying all that, state the question. Maybe I'm not hearing it right, but that's how I seem to want to respond. Let's do the question again.
Yeah, well, basically, I didn't even put it so much in terms of a question on a piece of paper. Just like,
oh, you thought
I'm just kind of interested. Just
what was the question? Just I don't know. Do the question
actually.
Yeah. What is the question? Because I'm going to see if there's maybe something.
See, this is what I wrote in point form. I just wanted to ask you about jungle music.
Ask me something about it.
Well, just
I love jungle music. You know, what do you want to ask me?
Well, the fact that it's
I'm not being
no, I understand. No, I understand. Yeah. It's but it's taking dance music and sped it up. Like, I'm just wondering how much more can like everything be sped up?
Okay. I got an angle. Obviously, since all the beautiful, when print came in and split instrumentation out from speech and song went on, or speech out from song went on to be pop culture, and classical music came in with instrumentation and highly sophisticated, non-folk culture kind of singing, if at all, in opera. Print caused that. So you think of all the sophistications of classical music, and then avant-garde classical music, and then jazz, and then rock, but it all ends up with fucking music in the night where a guy's talking to you. That's music. You actually flip and go back to the beginning. Speech is no longer merged. Music is speech slowed down. No, it's music's now just speech. There's no music, just fucking speech. But it's an environment, so it has to have instrumental accompaniments, but the main figure is speech. That means in dance,
you have primitive dance, and then the cultural evolution within technological society of the different kinds of dancing. I mean, the waltz was considered barbaric at one point, like Elvis doing his hips, compared to the courtly masks before that. So obviously dance is wilder and wilder and more crazy, and now it's getting chip eyes and sped up. The final dance would be fucking someone standing still. You know what I mean? And maybe moving their finger. That's the same cycle of ending up where speech becomes music. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So it would go to fast, to it got to the point where the young kids would say, hey, if I just stand still, I'm encompassing all gestures. I am all gestures. So it'll just go like this. So that, and Marshall McLuhan predicted that. He said, our society will turn to stone. Like Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember he turned around and he turned to clay? So, you know, who was it? Lot turned around. It's that we are turning ourselves into nothing, into immobile nothing. And the way of saying that is we, it's already happened, is that we've disappeared.
Okay.
So dance will flip into non-dance.
Okay.
But it probably won't, if it doesn't, because there's always going to be young kids coming up who don't get to that state right away, so they're going to need movement. So they're always, maybe they'll retrieve waltzing. You know what I mean? That could be new for kids near 25 in high school. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the cultural mix, the collective unconscious, which is always becoming conscious, finally finds that a relevant, resonant garbage to retrieve because it fits with the technological sensibility that's been conditioned by Cold Fusion and Mir. If they're successful by the year 2005, everybody will feel, hey, I have everything, I'm an aristocrat. You know? Yeah. And suddenly the kids will want to waltz.
Okay.
And there'd be Johnny Lydon sitting there, you know, this guy, whatever he is, an ex-heron addict, fucking, he's mutated so much stuff through the years and this punk and all the things he's done, and he's looking at this, and he's watching his grandchildren going nuts, going ecstatic over waltzing. But see that, now what I'm basically saying, that's the warning, that you are in a society that you're going to be obsolete quite quickly. And you're going to have to deal with the horror your parents went through when you freaked them out.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
That's what the disservice of our society. And that's why everybody basically goes mad if they're not prepared for that.
Okay. This is a completely different train. Is writing a discarnate experience?
On the internet.
Even. But even on a, but putting words on a piece of paper, like you not out of your body?
No, discarnate is simultaneous. You're communicating immediately with everybody else. And you don't do that with writing. I don't know you're writing. But you're on the telephone or on TV or radio, you got millions of people sharing that electric space. So, no, all technologies up to the telegraph are not discarnate. The telegraph is the beginning of discarnate writing. And that's, see, McLuhan defines the telegraph as the electronification of writing, or the simultaneousness of writing. And the email is the satellite version of the telegraph.
Okay.
That's why my chart begins with the telegraph there.
But even the book that's out there, like among like thousands of readers or whatever, is that's not a discarnate experience?
No, because
it's not simultaneous.
Not simultaneous.
It's already on the page,
and it's not live.
It's not live. Yeah. Okay.
Electric technology is alive. It's organic. All mechanical technologies, like the book, which is the mechanization of the handicraft of the printing press, or the wine press, actually technological historical term. They are not, basically they're not talking to you. Anything that doesn't talk to you, you can't hear, is mechanical. But a radio, you can hear. Right. Television, you can hear. Computers, you can hear now. And see, when computers came in the 60s and 70s, they were visual. You type on them. They actually brought back the Gutenberg values temporarily. And that may be why the 70s was created the yuppie. It retrieved that visual 19th century bias temporarily. But then once you get into virtual reality or CD-ROMs where you have voice, then the computer can speak to you. So the mechanic is, and speech is the most first human technology in a way. It's the most intimate, the most all-encompassing medium. So when we get into the world where nothing, the objects aren't speaking to you, that's the mechanical phase. You could say, well, it begins with writing, but in our time, it's from the book up to just before the movie, I guess.
Okay.
The book and the newspaper and machines. A lump of steel doesn't talk to you.
Okay. I don't understand the vanishing point.
Okay. When you look at a horizon, that's the... You say, I can see the horizon, but I can't see beyond that. So there's something beyond that, that's vanished. Now, to go through the vanishing point is the next phase. I go through the eye effect of the feeling that there's something beyond the horizon which has vanished, but I know there's something there. Now, the phone rings. Pick up the phone, and I know, according to a map, there is Los Angeles is over the horizon from Toronto. And I pick up the phone, and someone from L.A. calling me. I can hear L.A. In other words, I can't see LA, but I can hear it. Not by a video intercom, I can see it. So I have gone through the vanishing point. I'm no longer limited just by the eye.
Okay.
So that's now then I talk about it metaphorically in Entertainment Sucks, right? About mystical death. When you die, you go through the vanishing point. So I work with a different multiple meanings there. But I just gave you a simple technological level meaning of going. So when the telegraph came in, we went through, we made contact with the area we couldn't see. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a technological ESP.
Okay. And you said something once that when you're discarnate, you don't think of it in terms of
me
or
anybody. Right,
it's over there.
Yeah.
Like you're not really, like I'm not talking to Moscow on the phone.
No, it's in your head. It's not even in your ear, it's in your central nerve. Moscow's inside your head.
Okay.
In other words, the eye defines you over there, and me here, and you see distance, and linearity, and center margin. All these fragmenting things are properties of the eye, and the sense of space the eye creates and defines. But Dave could be hearing us maybe in the other room. He can take in stuff through the acoustics. So the acoustics are more penetrating, more holistic, more involved, more people, and more unifying as a sensory modality than the eye, right? So mechanical technology basically imitated the fragmenting aspect of the eye, and electric technology imitates the unifying holistic effect of the ear. See, so that's why the acoustic age is the 20th century versus the visual 19th century. What was your point? Responding to the Moscow point?
The idea that discarded. I used to think in terms of, I'm talking to California or whatever.
It's a very simple point, but it's amazing that human beings, see, we're not trained in our sensory modality. These points, they could be mentioned to a person in grade 8, and as soon as they heard it, they'd understand it. They'd forever know that. But it's the characteristics of our senses have never been discussed, especially in Western culture. Because we, being visually fragmented through writing, developed a hatred of the body, or we just were fragmented, which wasn't bad, it's just the effect of visual space, so we didn't like talking about the senses, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because we were into the novelty of the visual sense, which was the only sense that could be abstract and be isolated. So we're into isolation, and that was the whole realm of capitalism and individualism and nationalistic wars, all this conflicting over spaces and eye boundaries, alright? Now, what was the next point? You might just have to say a word or two. So now, the Oriental cultures, the non-writing cultures, they're more central. The cliches about their work, they dance and more in their bodies, because they didn't get as fragmented by the alphabet. They weren't industrialized. They are now, but in the basic archetypal difference. But those cultures don't even exist anymore. We're all inside the satellite effect and the disappearance of that. You couldn't just use Oriental knowledge about the senses. Because the Orientals didn't know that the technologies that the Western fragmented man was creating were extensions of the senses. That's why McLuhan and Joyce's breakthrough of Fitting His Wake, where he understood this, was new knowledge, post-Freud, post-Jung, post-Darwin, post-everybody, because he understood that you could use the senses as a metaphor for these new technologies, and also he had to teach the people the properties of each sense that we don't think about. And once you understood the property of senses, you just figured out at some point when you realized what this kind of meant, then you realize, oh, the machines are simulating that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a very simple point, but it's funny how we're unconscious to the cultural sensory biases we have.
Okay.
And everybody thinks they're talking to L.A. And once you understand my point, you're not. Fucking L.A. is here. And someone calling him, I can be in L.A., I can call L.A. now, and I can get something done there. That's like telekinesis.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm using someone else to go over the room and eat a cheese or find an album, play it to me over the phone. You know what I mean? Matter of fact, are we there? I don't have to have all of me there. I don't have to cause me an ESP, but I got enough to get something done to affect this reality. So that's why we call it discarnate or beyond our normal sensory ability. We have electronic ESP we have.
Okay. What about the idea with this whole lady guy situation? The idea kind of came out in the media that we, being the audience or whatever, are all complicit in her death for reading the papers.
Well, yes, because everybody's disappeared. There's only two people alive, Bob and Connie. And when we found out that they died, I walked away from the scene of the paper. I said, again, fuck, they almost killed us. That's what I said, okay? Because there's lots of reasons why the death of Diana was an attempt on Connie's life. But we're not only all implied, that was true once you had radio and TV and electronic environments, because we're all inside our central nervous system. We're all electrons, all resonating in one little spot, since from radio and then TV. And then the computer and satellite even implode that. Now, the satellite's disappeared since 77. Everything's disappeared. There's been nothing but Bob and Connie. Then you guys aren't involved. You guys aren't all involved. That's a machine, an after-image machine, trying to pretend he's still here and getting you to identify him. And you actually are just a representative of other machines. Because newspapers want television to say it, so newspapers can have something to write, and the TV want to make polling so they can find out what the readers of the newspaper think about them or about themselves. So it's just machines. Did you read Fatty Communion? This is Fatty Communion?
No, I haven't read Fatty Communion.
Oh, you didn't read it before I came?
Oh, no, the thing you gave me, yeah, that thing.
I didn't mean
you read your book, yeah. No, I did read this, yeah.
Yeah, so I might be reminding you of saying the Fatty Communion between machines. Mm-hmm. Saying hello very inviolably to each other. Remember I said that?
So
if everything's disappeared and the machines are trying to fool you that they're still here, and they're trying to pretend that this integrated electron is still resonating, but I'm telling you that that's even gone. It's not all you are not involved. The only people involved are Bob and Connie, and they didn't get killed, so it didn't happen. They didn't die. Only the machines trying to say that it happened, one of our machine images fucked up and malfunctioned, and so we can say that we have something that continues our existence that is a response to the challenge that we're not here anymore. That was complex, but I'm trying to almost be like Finnegan's Wake.
Okay.
Because language breaks down in saying this. But so you see that you don't even exist to be involved.
Well, how would you explain that, though?
Yeah, can I prove that?
Supposing you were talking, this kind of sounds ridiculous, brother, but supposing you're actually talking to someone who physically did know these people, how would you say the same thing?
I'd say that, can you prove to me you fucking knew them? Can you bring Charles over here and do it? And then it's, yeah, so they bring Charles over. I said, how do I know you didn't pre-stage this? How do I know Charles has a motive to do this? They could not prove it. They could only say, the only way they could attempt to prove it is to translate into a medium. Here's a tape recording of me talking to them. And they'd have to start relying on other languages, other machines to prove their case. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm on to a defense here of my point. You know what I mean? You see, I don't give a fuck if they think they did. Because it has no relevance to the issues today. So you fucking knew the person. That is not what people are responding. Not one of those 5 billion people who cried their ass off about it ever met fucking Di. And if they
not
did,
not one.
Well, maybe 10. But what are 10? As Bernard Shaw came up one time after the end of a play, and the audience was cheering him, and one person booed. And booed the play, and George Bernard Shaw said, "I quite agree with you, sir, but what are we two against so many?" You know, the majority of people only experience Di as a machine image. If 2,500 people actually met Di, so what then? If they shook hands, I know it was that. Might have been a fucking double. How they went? They didn't track her every way.
Yeah.
That's a good point, eh? They could have been a fucking double. And what? Well, how did you interact? So, you know what I mean? This is where the machines run the show, where language runs the show now.
So how do I know I'm with Bob Dawes?
Well, the obvious answer is you don't, and you weren't, and you never will be, and that's why you don't exist. That's why I'm a saint to actually spend time with nothing and talking to it. Not to put you down, but I'm trying to correct that. I will bring you back. If you actually have real good advantage, but you actually met something that imitated the physical version of Bob. You know what I mean? So you saw a guy get the D cell. You know what I mean?
Is this a holographic thing that we're engaging? Is this a holy?
At least that. It's holopathic. It's tinier and tinier. The hologram doesn't even exist anymore. It's invisible holograms. Why I call it homeopathic or holopathic. It hasn't even gone. I mean, look at the chart. Holopathic PGA probes. See, all the machines pretty well gone by 1960. So from 60 to 77, you have the holopathic PGA probes all gone by 77. So what happened from 77 to 92? Anthropomorphic physical. Bob and Connie looking like human forms, only that wasn't real until 1990 or 92. The whole world, all the machines watched to see if Bob and Connie would make it to 90. Or 92. And we made it. And that's the big celebration. That's why I'm happy that we made it and you guys have a chance of getting retrieved.
So does the rest of the planet have to catch up to you? Or how was that?
Not catch up. They have to be retrieved.
Okay.
And the only way to do it is under new being, and that's Akasha on the chart there. Akasha.
You look under Bob, you'll see.
Like Akasha, right?
Yeah, that's a theosophical term.
And what does that mean, like?
That's neither earth.
Thoughts go or something?
That's neither Rai, Eloi, Tu, and Lofty, or earth, air, fire, and water. It's new matter. And Mir and cold fusion are new matter. Cold fusion creates energy. More energy comes out of it than goes in. That violates all our known understanding of friction-based principles.
It's frictionless. It's spirit. It's a second coming. It's something that humanity never had before. That's the new being that I'm telling you. This mirror is a technology that can get rid of, you know, the first time we ever had something to get rid of the infections of parasites, fungus, bacteria, and viruses. Never had the ability to get rid of that. This is amazing. And I think we should end with that.
Yeah, okay.
But you did get to the crux of the matter. You brought it right up. Anybody listening says, oh, this is around the time Dai died, because that was the latest news thing they eventually get to.
Yeah.
Because we went back to, like, an Elvis. Hey, all the spirals in between.
Okay, that's excellent.